In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast series here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, the host of the channel. Tonight, we'll be talking to Christopher Catarine about the topic of leaving academia and his new book, Leaving Academia, A Practical Guide. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you so much for having me, Christina.
I'm so glad that you're here, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic. I wondered if we could start off by having you tell us about yourself.
I got my PhD in classics in 2014 from the University of Virginia. After that, I ended up teaching as a visiting assistant professor for 3 years. My wife had a job at a university, and they had a visiting position open, so I ended up working there. During that time, I became involved in contingent faculty issues, and my wife and I are in the same discipline. So we faced the two-body problem, and over time, for a variety of reasons, I came to see that maybe academia wasn't actually the path that I wanted for myself, even though up until about age 30, I'd been quite committed to that that future. So starting in 2015, I began exploring careers outside of academia, and in 2017, I was able to secure a job as a communication strategist and proposal writer for a global consulting firm, and I've been working there since August of 2017.
And so that leads to the next question, which is, why did you decide to write this book?
When I was leaving and I looked around at what resources were available, it was the heyday of Quitlet. And I looked at that and I said, well, this is good and cathartic that people are saying I'm leaving and letting people know. But it always kind of bothered me because I didn't really know what to do with Quitlet. It told me that I could have feelings and that was fine, but I didn't really know what to do with them from there. On the other hand, there were resources available that seemed to tell you how to change careers, or you could do this or that, but they seemed almost so practical without acknowledging that emotion in the way that I was looking for, that I dismissed them out of hand. And so after I made the switch myself, I said, you know, hey, this is actually a gap in the current resources as I saw them. And over lunch with some friends, actually at an academic conference in January 2018, those friends convinced me to maybe start thinking about that and outline it as a book. And so I ended up doing that in early 2018, and in early 2019, I shopped it around with some publishers, and here we are.
And at some point, there was a blog.
Yes. So while I was leaving the academy, I was aware of the fact that I didn't have as much obviously relevant experience as some employers would have liked, and so I began doing as many different things as I could to build experience. And one of those was a blog that chronicled my departure from higher education, that also got into contingent faculty issues. And really, that was an opportunity for me to do two things. One was to develop a public writing persona and tone that started shaking off some of those academic tics, you know, the ways in which, you can just say how, that's all right. So kind of getting rid of that stuff, trying to talk more like a non-academic, a layman, a normal person, as it were. Yeah, so I ended up having the blog to in part do that, and the other part of it was also that I really wanted to say publicly that I was leaving academia so that I couldn't chicken out and try to go back on it. There was a little bit of psyching myself up to do something that I was very much afraid of and nervous about, and at a certain point I knew that in spite of the fear, the best thing for me to do was to do something I couldn't go back on, and so writing the blog was also a way to force myself forward, even if I didn't want to do it.
And so if we can unpack that a bit, when you went to grad school, you thought, when you finished, you would be a professor. Like, there was just a sort of blinders on, straightforward path, and that's where you were going to go. Is that right?
Yeah, when I was a sophomore in college, I remember having a meeting with the dean, and he looked at the courses that I'd selected, and he said, "You can't take all of these. They're all in the classics department." And I said, "Well, I know that's what I want to study." And he was convincing me that no, that's or he tried to convince me that no, that's not a very good idea. You need to diversify your courses. And so I said, "Well, thank you very much." And I changed one or two things to the bare minimum to make it acceptable, and then went back to taking as many courses in classics as I could. And for me, that was just what I wanted to do. And I wasn't really interested in listening to advice to the contrary, even at age 19. So for me to go from undergrad, then into grad school, full steam ahead, pursuing a PhD in classics, that really was the career that I wanted. And I would say that really until I was about a year past the PhD, I had never really given any other career second thought. And it was only when I confronted some of the realities of the job market, even back then in 2015, that I began to consider other paths.
How much did your professors at grad school or symposiums or programs that were offered to graduate students urge you all to think of jobs outside academia or even lay out for you what those might be?
They did not. That's the simple answer. They really didn't. It was a extremely rigorous and conservative program. I gather it's changed a bit since, but the program I was in was really there to train the next generation of classical philologists, people who study how individual words and narratives fit together to convey meaning in literature. And that was what it was aimed to do. So I don't think I had ever considered careers. I didn't know anybody who had talked openly about looking for careers outside of the academy until quite late. There were of course, people who left after getting a master's and went on to do other things. Somebody who went to law school, for instance. But those people were the exception. And I would say that certainly my attitude when I saw them depart and do what they did was that they had failed. And that just meant that I was one step closer to getting a job because there was one less person competing for it. So really, this was not a way that I'd been conditioned to think. And I did feel like I had to forge my own path, which probably wasn't as true as I thought it was. There are a lot of good resources out there now. There were probably more than I knew about in 2015. But it was a radical change. I really had been trained, I'd kind of come up thinking that I would be a professor, but I'd been trained to think that that was the job that I was being prepared to do, and that there was no other job to do.
And so you graduate, and now you and your wife both have PhDs, and you both want to try to get professor jobs. Is that when you became aware of the statistics that you have in the book? It's something like 7% of PhDs are going to get hired as professors. I mean, it's a really small number.
Yeah, that number is pre-COVID, and I think that's the tenure track number. Is about 7%. I didn't actually piece that together until a little bit later when I was working on contingent faculty issues and began to start digging into what the numbers actually looked like. Really, the reason I initially began looking outside is that there was just what we thought was a bad year in my discipline where, for some 300, 400 applicants, there were about 50 tenure track jobs. And I said, oh, those numbers don't seem great. And the following year, it was fewer. I think it was down to 35. And the year after that, in my sub-discipline, there were actually no jobs at all. And so no tenure track jobs at all, I should say. And so it was really a growing awareness of how hard it was to get one of these jobs. And also the realization that spousal hires don't actually exist anymore unless you're being brought in as an experienced hire for the most part. And that my wife and I kind of had to choose between living together and one of us changing careers or living apart and both of us being classicists, and living apart was not really an option for us.
And you include in the book numbers about adjunct work. I think currently it's something like 75% of classes are actually taught by adjuncts, but adjuncts don't make a living wage. And when you and your wife were trying to look at your future goals and your family goals, it wasn't possible really for the two of you to meet those goals unless you actually had a full-time job with a decent salary. Can you talk about how the tenure, how the adjunct track is really a very difficult one for people if they need to make an income?
The adjunct life is really hard. And if you are somebody who is independently wealthy, who has a partner who can allow you to teach one or two courses a semester, or has other interests and do that on the side, it can be an okay way to go. But to treat adjuncting as full-time work is just nonsense. I think the last average that I saw was that people were getting somewhere between $2,700 and $4,000 per class to teach as an adjunct. And so even if you end up, you know, stacking up four of these things each semester, if you're allowed to do so at your university, you're still not making very much money. You usually don't get benefits. And certainly if you're spreading those out over multiple universities, you not only won't get benefits, but you also need to deal with the inconvenience of juggling multiple academic calendars simultaneously, email addresses and the like. And really, when I was working on contingent faculty issues, there was a really kind of simple matter of professional identity that became really obvious to all of us on the committee. And it was that people's email addresses kept changing, and universities would shut off an email address. And very often you would have somebody who you were trying to stay in touch with, to build a professional relationship with, and you couldn't actually do it. So there's the monetary side of things, which is real, and I think primary. But there's also this other side of it, which is that if you're trying to build a professional identity as an adjunct, the cards are really stacked against you, and the systems in place are not going to allow you to do the types of things that you need to do to qualify for a tenure track job, which is going to be largely based on your research output anyway.
And one of the other hidden problems that you bring to light in the book is what you call the tenure trap job. Not the tenure track job, but the tenure trap job. Can you tell listeners what that is?
The tenure trap job is a tenure track position that somebody takes in a geography where they really don't want to be at a school that is really a bad fit for them. In the case of my wife's story, which is by extension my story, that came in the form of a tenure track offer at a small religious liberal arts school in the Midwest that ended up being a bad fit for us and for her for lots of reasons. But one of the biggest problems with a school like that is that very often the library is not going to be terribly well maintained. You may not have access to things that you need to do research. If you're a scientist, you probably won't have the type of lab that you need to sustain serious research. And I think that there are a lot of people who say, well, a tenure track job is the thing I'm in this to get. And so the moment they get an offer of any tenure track job at all, they say yes. But if you take a job thinking that you're going to be able to use it as a stepping stone to something else, and the position doesn't actually allow you the time or the resources or the mental bandwidth to do the things you need to do to actually make that happen, you could find yourself stuck in one of these positions, you know, earning tenure and maybe having a stable life, but not having a happy life. And when I looked at the tenure track jobs that were being listed in the years when I was on the academic job market, one of the other things that I started to realize is that maybe 5% of those jobs were in places that I wanted to be. And I remember even considering one that was, I think, a 2.5-hour drive from the nearest major interstate, not airport, but interstate. And I just said, wow, I mean, how that just wasn't a way that I wanted to live. I wanted to be able to travel, to see family. Being that remote was not something I wanted to get stuck in. And so I'd kind of become aware of the fact that this type of position was there. And then in writing the book, I was able to coin this term. And I have to say, I was quite happy that nobody beat me to it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So after you and your wife both jumped in to academia and then started to see what you got yourself into, she ultimately turned down that offer for the tenure track job and decided to stay at a academic job she had that was not tenure track, but it was a renewable position. Is that right?
That's right.
And you decided you were going to have to leave academia, which you take us through in the book. And I really appreciate how you really unpack your experience and you kind of lay it bare for us, because we're there with you in your shell shock. You never really thought that was going to be a decision you would have to make. And yet you and your wife start talking about how you can unpack all of these trade-offs that you had just silently accepted during grad school as normal. And yet most jobs never expect you to make those trade-offs. And so you start thinking about things like salary, location, getting to live with your wife, the timing that you can plan on family creation. Will you be near your extended family? What about community building? What about your psychological health? What benefits do you want? What are your personal values? And figuring out your career trajectory, which is a lot when you've spent years being conditioned to think that none of those were going to be your choices. Can you talk to us about that and how you you urge in the book that people should keep a journal while they're unpacking these things and figuring out what matters to them?
Yeah, I'm guilty in that of not being a good journaler myself, but I know that it's a habit that can be really good for people. And for me, really, I tend to process information by talking to people. And my wife is very patient and put up with a lot of these conversations about what we were going through and then what I was going through. But really, I think, you know, the event that you refer to is that after she was offered this tenure track job, unexpectedly, she didn't think she was going to be offered it at all after how the on-campus interview had gone. The school did invite us up to visit, and we went up together, and we really ended up having these long conversations in the car, and then when we got back about what we actually wanted, and it was sort of jarring to be driving between the nearest city and the small town where the school was, and talking about how we could do really interesting things potentially with classics in the our community in New Orleans and ways to tie it back. And I looked at her and I said, this is nuts that we're sitting here thinking about a future in this place where we are now, but our mind keeps going back to the place where we live. That really has to mean something. And from there, we said, okay, well, maybe we want to choose where we live. Maybe we want to stay in New Orleans. Okay, that's a good thing to know. It was probably a couple years later when I came around to the idea that having a good salary was actually something that mattered a great deal to me. My wife and I both came from reasonably privileged backgrounds. We didn't want for anything. It wasn't like we could have anything we wanted, but we certainly weren't in need. And I did have this realization at one point around the time I was turning 30 that if we had kids, when we had kids, they would never really get anything close to the semblance of the life that my wife and I had enjoyed if the two of us stayed in academia. And there was also a, you know, in terms of my leaving and her staying, a practical element as well, which is that her position was renewable and mine was a visiting position that was terminal. And so she could stay and she had that choice. And for me, you know, what I told people when I was leaving is that at the end of 3 years, whether I have been the best professor they have ever had or I have been completely horrible and worthless, that university is going to let me go. It makes absolutely no difference. It's just a timed contract. And when I tried to explain that to people in business, they didn't get it because it's absolutely insane. And realizing that actually there are professions where, sometimes you might run into a timed terminal contract, but more often than not, you're expected to stick around as long as you want to or as long as they need you. That was also eye-opening to me. And I realized maybe that was a better way to live and work.
And one of the things you point out in the book, which I really appreciated, is you said billions of people support themselves by working outside academia. I wondered if that was something you had to remind yourself of as you were trying to figure out, well, what do I do now, though?
The world that you live in academia is so small, and yet it feels so big. And classics especially, you know, it's probably, by the time you factor in all the professors and secondary school teachers and grad students and all of that, maybe you've got a conference, an archaeologist too, you've got maybe a conference of 5,000 people. I mean, that's just nothing. It's so small. And I did start to realize that, you know, my dad has been a financial consultant for most of my life. My mom has been a CPA my entire life. I have friends who'd gone into consulting, friends who'd gone into law. My sister is in marketing. And I started to realize I had absolutely no idea what these people actually did day to day, even though they were the closest people to me. And I think when I realized that I didn't actually know what my mom did, that was one of those moments for me where I said, oh, wow, I've been missing something really obvious here. I thought that I was committing to a career because I knew it and understood it and knew how it was better than the alternatives. But in fact, I kind of just made a bunch of assumptions about what was a good job and what was a bad job when I was in my 20s, and I didn't actually know anything about those jobs. And I just kind of committed to doing something. That was eye-opening. And so I did begin a process slowly at first and then much faster of conducting informational interviews where you ask for a meeting with somebody just to inquire about what they do and how they got there. And if you hit it off with them, to go on to ask them where they think they might be going in the future, really just as a way to learn about what you might be able to do and if you might be interested in doing something adjacent to what they do. And that for me became a really exciting and engaging, interesting way to start learning about what those billions of other people actually do. But it came from a recognition and an admission of, I think simultaneously, my ignorance about what those jobs actually were, and also really my arrogance in assuming that I did know, and in assuming that the path that I'd chosen for kind of silly reasons around age 20 were actually valid.
And one of the other things you did was you reached out to other people who had also left academia to find out what had happened to them. Are you able to share a couple of those stories?
Oh, I have a lot of them at this point because I've spoken with a good number of people. I think some of the ones that I share in the book, there was one guy who had written a piece. His name's Mike Zim, and he'd written a piece in the Chronicle for Higher Ed about how he got a PhD in ancient history at Yale and then went on to work at a marketing firm in New Haven. And I saw this. I said, well, this is a crazy story, and I'm trying to do this. I should really talk to this guy. So I sent him an email, even though I'd never met him before. And probably within 2 days, we'd scheduled a 30-minute phone call. And he ended up putting me in touch with about 7 other former academics. But he just told me about his path. And Mike is a guy of I'd say unique charisma. And he had the good fortune of being in a mid-sized market with some companies that were punching above their weight. And so he just started walking into businesses in New Haven and asking to talk to the CEO. And if they said no, he would walk out. And if they said yes, he'd make a 15-minute pitch. And eventually he was able to convince somebody that even if he didn't know how, having an ancient historian on staff was probably a good idea. Again, Mike's unusual. But he was able to do this. The more normal path, I think, is that people end up conducting informational interviews, feeling out what types of jobs they might want to do, and that practice of informational interviews morphs into networking over time. And at a certain point, you do start building relationships with people who understand kind of what your strengths are in ways that you might not understand, what your potential in a different environment might be in ways that you don't. And they will eventually start connecting you to potential opportunities as they arise. And so, I'm thinking about other academics that have gone on to other things. And I can think of a number in consulting, which is the field that I'm in. And I think almost everybody that I know in consulting ended up getting their job because they just spoke with somebody who was already in it and they had a good conversation. They seemed to be a good personality fit and at the right moment in their life and career and career change. And that led to more conversations with people who didn't have an academic background, but it went well. So that's sort of two versions of how you leave. One is you just have a great deal of charisma and can talk a good game and convince somebody that you're worth their time, and then prove it. And the other one is that you do this kind of slower, more disciplined habit of informational interviews and networking, and use that to create opportunities. And one of the studies that I mentioned in the book came out from LinkedIn. So, take this with a grain of salt, but at least their number was that 87% of mid-career hires are brought in by referral rather than by application. And I think most people who have a PhD will be viewed as a mid-career hire. And so that means that the likeliest path to getting a job is actually by meeting people rather than just submitting applications into the void.
And one of the other things you did was you reached out to some former mentors to talk it through with them. Someone that you reached out to, he was actually an administrator kind of high up in academia. Can you tell us about that?
You must be referring to Dan Porterfield.
And
Dan was somebody that I knew while I was an undergrad at Georgetown. At that point, he was a vice president. And he's a really charismatic guy. I'm probably overusing that word at this point, but Dan really is, and he has a really keen eye for how to build community and how to build up people to create something bigger than individuals. And I didn't know Dan well when I was an undergrad, but I knew that he was an English PhD, that he had this administrative job, that he seemed really happy, and that he was doing stuff that I admired. And so when I first had this fear that maybe I wasn't going to be one of those lucky people to get an academic job, a tenure track job, Dan was actually the first person that I messaged, and I did it out of desperation because I didn't really know where else to turn. He was the only person who had done something different with a PhD that I actually knew. And when I sent him a Facebook message in, I think it was the spring of 2015 or 2016, you know, at that point he was president of Franklin and Marshall College, and so I really did not expect a response. But because Dan is the kind of person who is good at cultivating people and at building communities, he made 30 minutes for me. And you know, that conversation, which I recount in the book, was valuable in a lot of ways, but one of them was that it showed me that asking for help is okay, and getting advice is can be intimidating, but people are often happy to do it. And also, for somebody who was a visiting assistant professor to realize that I just had a 30-minute phone call with the university president, I felt like a million bucks. And that boost of confidence, you know, coupled with his advice of practical ways to move past the crippling dread that I was feeling in that moment, really did help me move forward. And it wasn't instant; it took time, but it did kind of set me down that path. So for me, you know, with Dan, that was sort of the lesson is that ask people for help, even if you think you might be wasting their time or bothering them, even if you think that they're too important for you to spend their time on. There is really no harm in asking. The worst that happens is they say no or don't reply. And if they actually say yes, you've put yourself in a position to get a lot of very good advice quickly. And if you're changing careers, that's something that you need a lot of.
One of the things I like about the book is you let us know that we don't have to completely cold turkey leave everything about academia. And part of the proof of that is that your book is published by an academic press. we're not all going to do that, but you also have other ways that people can stay connected to the academic things that they're passionate about. Can you talk a bit about that and how you've done it?
I've seen people do lots of different things. There are some who maintain a research profile and they manage to get a courtesy appointment to a library at a local university so they can get access to materials there. And they keep working on what they did before in their spare time. It doesn't happen at quite the same speed as it did before, but they can stay engaged and involved. I've met people who ended up getting into blogging or podcasting as a way to maintain a presence in that space, but with a focus more on translating academic materials for popular audiences. That can be one way that people do it. And I think every former academic I know, with the exception of one, it has put an awful lot of time into coaching other people from their discipline who are leaving. It's not an easy thing to do. I think I don't know anybody who's had a breeze trying to exit, and most of us are eager to make time to help people out by talking to them and advising them as they do what we did. And our perspective on that changes too as we move on in our careers and do different things. So those are sort of three options for how you can engage. There are many more besides that, I think, but those are sort of an extreme staying in of research, a medium of doing sort of translation for a public audience, and a light of really just advising people who left. And for me, it really, I did fall into that last category. I think most of the work that I've done has focused on advising other people, although I have also had opportunities to present to the chairs of PhD granting institutions in classics to talk about ways that they might, if not reimagine grad education, at least start broadening some of the outcomes for people with a PhD by thinking a little bit more creatively about how programs are structured, whether you need to actually have a seminar paper at the end of every course, things like that. So I suppose my connection has been more on the advocacy side.
And you give a lot of practical advice in the book too. People who are now going to be in the workforce outside academia about the etiquette, about how to handle yourself. And some of the tips that you gave may at this point seem obvious to you, but they were surprising to me. One is, you know, don't tell people you have a PhD. That won't sit the same way with people outside academia as it will inside academia. And you also tell people to ask more questions than they answer. And I sat with that one for a minute. And I was like, oh, right. That is the opposite of what we've been trained to do. We've been trained, you know, when we've been asked a question, we need to not only answer, we need to answer it thoroughly. And so you let us know, no, it's a new culture. You're going to be asking questions and you urge us to have economy of speech. Can you take us through some of those tips and explain why in this new world, these are really important things so that we don't misstep?
The biggest one is that you, outside of the academy, you don't know how somebody is going to view people with a PhD and how they are going to view somebody with an academic background. I think we all know that there are people of certain political persuasions who view academia with suspicion. You may encounter some of these people, and if you tell them that you were a professor for a time or a grad student for a time, they may dismiss you out of hand. And because you don't know that, it can be helpful to keep that background a little bit quiet. On the other hand, I spoke with somebody who, and I recount this in the book, who works at an executive branch department for the U.S. government. And because of how it was founded historically, and because it's relatively recent, some of the people in leadership positions only have a high school diploma. And so all of a sudden, if you start talking about your PhD in front of people who didn't go to college, you could look like you're trying to tell them you know better. And that might not be interpreted the right way either. And that's not a political determination. It's just a background determination. And so you need to be careful of that, and you need to understand what that culture is. And I think that really gets to the heart of it, is that until you really know what your new work environment values, what that culture is, how people think and talk and communicate, the safest thing to do is not to assume that they will value you, but to assume that they won't, and to be quiet and to ask questions so that you can gain that information as quickly as possible. And there may eventually come times where you realize talking about that background could be beneficial. You could turn it into an advantage. And when you see that, you absolutely should, but you want to make sure you know what you're doing first. I think the second part of your question was really about economy of speech. And this is less about not putting your foot in your mouth as it is that people in other sectors tend to be managing many, many more things at once than academics do. And I know that all academics will say they are busy, and especially here we are in November at the end of probably the most challenging semester anybody has had. Things are busy and they feel busy, but the number of tasks that you have is dwarfed by people in executive positions, in leadership positions, in business. They have lots of teams working for them doing different things, and they're trying to keep it all straight. And so, I'm in consulting. I'm in one of these environments where there's a fairly aggressive brevity of speech, and that's because people just can't be bothered with non-essential information. And one of the risks that you have in an environment like that, if you give a full and long-winded answer, is that people will miss the most important information. And the best thing that you can do to help people make the decisions that they need to make is to figure out what they need to know and give them that information first. And if they ask for follow-up or more clarification, be ready with the additional details. It's not like you can't know them, but you need to always be thinking not only about your understanding of things, but also about the understanding of that topic that other people need to have to do their job, and control the flow of information in a way that helps them succeed. Because that's something that you don't really need to do in academia. And so it requires a good deal more thought, I think, when you end up in a situation where you are working with people and for people.
And one of the other things you mentioned is that most academics are introverts. And I I completely am an introvert by nature, and academia encourages us into that role even more rather than expanding us out of it. And yet when you leave academia, being an introvert is not so much of an attribute. So one of the things that you talk about is the importance of making time for small talk. Can you talk about that, please?
I assumed that when my company hired me at the salary they were willing to pay me to do the types of strategic communications and writing that they were asking me to do, that they simply couldn't afford that unless every single minute was spent being productive. And I think, I spoke a little bit earlier about some of the arrogance that I had and ignorance that I had when I began exploring new jobs. And this is a good example of it. I assumed business people must just want to get down to business. And there are times where that is true when you are under deadline, but so many businesses at its heart, a collective endeavor to do something and to profit from it. And because it's a collective endeavor, it means that you need people cooperating and working together. And sometimes people who don't necessarily get along need to work together. And even if they do get along, working together can present its own challenges. You can be distracted by joking around, things like that. And for me, what I realized is that this personal connection that you have with the people on your team, with your bosses, with everybody, is actually essential, because there are moments in any job where you're on a team where things go sideways. Either somebody blows a deadline and the client is upset, or new information comes out and fundamentally changes or contradicts your assumptions and requires a whole bunch of rework. And you get stuck dealing with people who are frustrated, working late and tired. I think during COVID, we all know that people are distracted with families and pets and kids at home, worry about the disease itself, about politics and elections and all of that. People are almost never functioning at their best. And when people aren't functioning at their best, the worst thing that can happen is to stop assuming good intent in other people. Because when that happens, work stops. And when work stops, that's it. The game is over. And so actually taking time to talk to people about, what they do over the weekend, whether they have families or kids, how they like to spend their time. These human points of contact can be really valuable, because when things get bad, and they will always get bad in a job at some point, those become things that you can fall back on that help you maintain that trust and that assumption of good intent, even when you're tired and haven't eaten and are cranky and hangry, and everybody else is too. And that is very often the thing that kind of keeps you moving and gets you past whatever that rocky situation is, so you can still do what you need to do. I have a mentor at work, and back when we could travel, and I used to travel most weeks for work, he said, I always keep a bar of extremely good chocolate in my briefcase. He said, because if we end up being here past 9 or 10 at night, nobody's going to be happy. And sometimes pulling out that good bar of chocolate is exactly what you need to smooth things over and let people get out by 11. And I saw that bear itself out a lot of times.
One of the things I noticed in the book is some of the tips that you gave us make me realize that some of the things that we learned in academia would be considered sort of toxic if we use them in a different environment. And one of the pieces of advice you gave was, don't deconstruct bad ideas. And while in academia, that's an important thing to do, in the work environment, it's the opposite. Your advice instead was to be kind and to be constructive. Can you talk about, in the few minutes we have left, some of those maybe things from academia that we don't want to take with us because in the new environment, it would be toxic, and what we might want to use as a replacement behavior?
Yeah, the reflex to deconstruct is one that I don't know that it needs to be jettisoned. It can be helpful, but it needs to be qualified. And if you are going to say why something doesn't work, you need to be prepared to say why that is a problem for the business issue or you know, nonprofit issue at hand, and also what you think should work better. Because if you're just saying why things won't work, that's not helping the team. All it's doing is shooting things down and not letting work proceed. If at the same time, if you come at that with a constructive criticism and say, hey, I don't think this is going to work for X, Y, and Z reasons, but if we take that one core idea that you had and maybe turn it in this direction or add in X, Y, or Z, and I think we can get someplace good, that can help things along. And again, the goal is to keep things moving forward so you don't just get to a standstill, but also you don't want to be perceived as just cutting down somebody's argument for the or idea for the sake of it, for the same reason that you know, building rapport is good. You need to work with these people. And if they decide that you don't like them, they will treat you in kind, and that isn't going to be terribly good for you either. And Christine, you had a second part of that question. Can you repeat it for me?
Oh, I think you answered it. It was really about a replacement behavior for things that we learn to do so thoroughly in academia. But if we take them outside academia, we will offend people. It was,
you asked me for two examples rather than one. And I think the other one really is being concise. And the best example of this is that you shouldn't give the most important piece of information as the last line in an email. It should always be the first. And I think in academia, we are trained to demonstrate that we understand the scholarship, all of the things that have been done before, and then to explain why they haven't worked. And only then, you know, then and only then are you justified in promoting your idea and saying, this is what I think is a better idea, and here's why. And that is how academics are trained to communicate. And you simply don't need to do that in a business setting. Most people don't care about all of the detailed deliberation that went into whatever determination you've made. They just need to know what it is. And you need to lead with that information. And then if you do feel compelled to provide some kind of supporting justification, you should stick to only the most critical things that kind of justify it, and then stop. And if people want more information, they can ask. Again, you need to have that at the ready, but you need to give them that information in the order and in the size that they're expecting it.
That is really helpful. Thank you. What do you hope this conversation tonight sparks for listeners as they think about leaving academia?
If somebody is at that first stage where they have that inkling of doubt that things are going to work out, or they're realizing that maybe there aren't going to be jobs, especially with COVID, I talk about this as dread in my book, and I think almost every true believer in the academic mission goes through it. And I would hope that this conversation would give you at least some hope that even if you are still feeling that dread when this recording stops, that you at least know about a resource or some resources that can help you start to think about moving past it, and that you are aware of the fact that that is a temporary feeling that you will move past, and that will open the way to new and better things. And I suppose I would end by saying that I could not have imagined being happy in a job outside of academia while I was inside of it. And now I can't believe how miserable I allowed myself to be during the whole time I was there. I'm much happier now, and I can't actually dream of going back.
Thank you for sharing all of that. And thank you for ending on that note. I think it's really encouraging for listeners. And the book we have been talking about is called Leaving Academia, A Practical Guide. Christopher Catterine, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. You've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. Please join us again.